Well, in order to talk about Mississippi, I'm going to start a little bit earlier and end a little bit later. And I'll be necessarily, in order to talk about this, I'll be giving you a little bit of a narrative, but there's certain threads that are important to me about this particular part of my life. One is being white, and especially being a white Southerner, and coming to terms with that in this movement atmosphere at the time. Another is finding and becoming a part of a movement, but understanding leadership in a movement. And for me, that came in Nashville, Tennessee, and that's where I'd like to begin the story. But just before I begin there, I'd like for Michelle to help me with this, because the movement for me, coming to activism in Nashville in the early 1960s, always felt like that it really saved my life in a lot of ways. It really snatched me out of one reality and put me on a different path. And the thing that's most demonstrated that for me is a poem by Charlie Cobb, which I found, or I think Charlie wrote this in the early 60s. And Michelle and I were talking about this last night, and the poem goes, and I don't think I said exactly right. Charlie says I'm a little bit off, but still, it works. And his poem is very simple. It says, "Sometimes when you dance out on a limb, it breaks, and you fall into a grassy meadow." And that's what the movement was for me, finding that little bit of whatever it took to dance out on that limb, and then falling into this movement of people who literally saved my life and helped me reshape and reclaim, you know, a life, I think. So I've always been grateful to Charlie for giving me that metaphor about that particular time. But as I said, I came to Nashville, Tennessee in 1961. And Nashville was a critical part of the civil rights movement because of the local movement there. It had phenomenal leadership, many of whom were still there when I arrived. Jim Lawson, who had taught some of the first nonviolent workshops in Nashville to SNCC people, was not there at the point, but he was revered and remembered and had a major impact on the SNCC people who were there at the time. There was a level of adult leadership in Nashville through the Nashville Christian Leadership Council that included the president of the local group, a man named Kelly Miller Smith, who had the church that was within five blocks of the downtown and which was the staging area for all of the demonstrations in Nashville. Large community support for the civil rights demonstrations and for the SNCC workers. Reverend Joe Lowry was still in Nashville at the time, so who later went to work with the Southern Christian Leadership Council. C.T. Vivian was in Nashville at the time. A man named Metz Rollins, who worked with the National Council of Churches, he was the adult advisor to SNCC. So there was this phenomenal level of leadership in Nashville, and that's the adult leadership. Then there was John Lewis, who was chairman of the local SNCC chapter. Lester McKinney, and I had forgotten that he had gone to Laurel and been a part of that project. Lester was, we called each other homeboy and girl, because if you see Corinth up there on the map, my hometown is just north of Corinth, about 25 miles, and Lester's hometown was Bolivar, Tennessee, which was just a little bit to the west of that, about 40 miles, so we were from the same area. But this home that I found in the Nashville movement was a very important... I'm sorry?
Diane Nash.
Diane Nash. Thank you for reminding me. I talked about her this morning. Diane Nash was one of the critical leaders in the Nashville movement. Now, she was gone by the time I got there, but her legacy and her name and what she stood for were certainly very prevalent. And Diane didn't come back through, but her husband, James Bevel, did occasionally to meet with the SNCC people there. So there was this incredible group of people coming from that. So, and like Zohara said, for me it was little by little. You start doing one little thing, and that leads you into something else, and you slowly, over time, you know, without quite realizing that you've done it, you're becoming more active and more involved. And I now work as an educator and have been very much in, influenced by the work of Paulo Freire, which Franny talks about. And Freire has a phrase about people becoming agents of their own lives, essentially becoming actors in their own lives rather than being acted upon. And this was the time in my life when it happened for me. This was the time when I became an actor in my own life, that beginning step by step, leading me somewhere else and beginning to take responsibility for my own actions and then finding this movement. So that's where it starts for me. And Mississippi really starts in the spring of 1964, in April of 1964, when several of us who worked in Nashville, who were mostly white students, but working with the SNCC leadership there, had been talking throughout that winter about the possibility of forming an organization that would work with white students on southern campuses across the region. Because we knew from reading the Southern Patriot, a newspaper of the Southern Conference Educational Fund, and talking to people like Ann Braden, who was one of the co-directors of the Southern Conference Educational Fund, that there were pockets of movement at these predominantly white schools across the South. We knew there was somebody active at Duke University. We knew that there were a few people active at UNC, and some not Mississippi. Mississippi was not included in that. But there were other places in the South where there were little pockets of activism. So we called a group, we called a conference in Nashville in April of that spring, in 1964, and we had less than 20, but we had 17 campuses represented from across the South. Marion Barry, who was in school at that time at the University of Tennessee, was one of the participants. Lester and John both participated in that meeting. And the whole discussion was about how can we create an organization that will pull and allow Southern white students away into this movement, and where they can be supportive of this Black-led movement rather than opposed to it, because there was an awful lot of resistance out there on the other end. So that was what we did. And that weekend we organized the Southern Student Organizing Committee. And we agreed that our first executive committee meeting for that organization would be in Oxford, Ohio, at the orientation for Mississippi Summer. Because we knew, I guess actually that was our second executive committee meeting, because we met with a SNCC group. We met with SNCC in Atlanta after that. But so our second executive committee meeting was in Oxford, Ohio. And because we knew that several of us were planning to go to Mississippi that summer and that that would be a good place to meet. So we arrived in Oxford. Some people arrived the first week because we were all going down to work in a particular project that was aimed at working with white people in Mississippi that summer. And I have often said, other people in this project do not agree with me on this, but I thought it was a great idea whose time had not yet come. Mississippi was absolutely polarized. The few white liberal ministers had already been run out of the state. People were getting killed. You know, the fact that you thought you could go find white people to come out and work on was just, it didn't work. Although there were people there who needed us to come in and talk with them, because they actually were sort of hiding out but being supportive. So there was some way in to talk to a few white Mississippians that summer. But in terms of a large organizing project to generate white support, it was just not going to happen. But we struggled. This was a project that had been approved by SNCC and by COFO, and recruited people to come down. It included white Southerners who were a part of SOC. It also recruited other white volunteers. We had one person in the project who was from Canada. We had another person who was at Union Theological Seminary in New York. So it had a number of people in the project, not all of whom were from the South, but many of us were. And so we went to Biloxi, Mississippi, was sort of the heart of this project, because it was felt that you could organize on the Gulf Coast. You certainly weren't going to be able to organize white people in the Delta of Mississippi, or perhaps more north, but along the Gulf Coast, perhaps. So we went to to Biloxi, and then I went first to Jackson, Mississippi, and worked with a wonderful woman named Jane Scott. And Jane Scott, probably, she's not well known. Did you remember Jane Scott at all? Did you, Bob? Jane Scott was a good Christian white lady from Jackson, Mississippi, and she had become a part of a local prayer group there and had expressed an interest in organizing a human relations council. So my first job that summer was to support Jane Scott and the Unitarian minister to put together a mailing list to begin sending out to, I think there were 500 names on the list, to see if there could just be the beginnings of a Mississippi Council on Human Relations. Now, years later, I would look back, and the Mississippi Council on Human Relations actually became a major player in Mississippi politics, but this was 15 or 20 years later. But that was just the beginning. And so I worked with this woman, Jane Scott, and Jane was one of the few visible white women in the movement, and she took a lot of stuff from her family and from her friends in Mississippi for being involved to the level that she was. But she hosted and worked with a group of women called Wednesdays in Mississippi. Remember that? Women from all over the country would organize themselves and come down to Mississippi, and have tea or something. I don't know what they did. Did you? I mean, I really don't know what they did, but the idea was they would come to Mississippi and they would get some press and visit the projects and be a visible level of support for COFO that summer. And Jane Scott always met with those groups and worked with them. So she was a good soul who really did put herself on the line there in many ways.
So wasn't it actually called White Gloves for Mississippi? And the Society
Collins.
The Society Collins in many places covered it as White Gloves for Mississippi. Very involved was Lucy Montgomery.
Lucy was involved in it. Yeah.
And the Society pages loved this.
People did love it.
White Gloves for Mississippi.
One of the stranger parts of the Mississippi Summer Program, I do believe, although it has been written about. But Jane was, a sort of a focal point for that group. And after spending a couple of weeks in Jackson, I went off to join my other project members in Biloxi. And, I'm a little, just to tell you, the day-to-day life of being in this project, we spent an awful lot of time sitting around talking about what we were going to do, frankly. I mean, as Zahara said when she arrived in Laurel, there was really no agenda. There was no plan for what you were going to do. So we would, every morning, we would talk about, well, what can we do? Who should we talk to? What should we do? And eventually there erupted a split within the White Folks Project. And a good friend of Bob's who had gone to the same school, Sam Shira, who also was a white field secretary for SNCC, right? Mm-hmm. Sam Shira was involved in the project. And Ed Hamlet, who also was a white field secretary for SNCC and paid for out of the Southern Conference for Human Welfare, Southern Conference Educational Fund to work with SNCC. Ann and Carl Braden had paid this position. Ed Hamlet was a project director. Sam Shira began very early to say we needed to work with the white working class, that we didn't need to be trying to go out and find white liberals in Mississippi to talk to support, but we ought to be out organizing the white working class. And he really pushed and pushed for us to go out and settle in a part of Biloxi that was a white working class community, mostly people who made their living by fishing. And he did that. A small group of people set up another Freedom House across town and moved into this community and didn't have a whole lot of luck, except they did find one person who listened to them, who changed his mind, and that person became a member of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and went to the National Convention at the end of the summer with them, and I think stayed active. I can't remember his name, but he's in the records, and he was, Sam really worked hard. Do you remember his name? Worked hard to get him there.
But he was
a biker. I mean, this guy was a biker and a fisherman, and who just, you know, I think he got, he resonated with Sam, and he wanted to do this, so he did join. But as I said earlier, I think the White Folks Project in Mississippi had, I think, my assessment of it is that it had very little import. It was a good and well-meaning attempt, and it indicated an interest on the part of SNCC and COFO and SOC to keep trying to reach out to the white community and undercut, you know, just to undercut some of that antagonism and meanness of spirit that was there, and to try to garner some support. And, you know, we made a few inroads, but it was, I think, in many ways, I've always thought of the White Folks Project as being something that was a side story. And it was. It was one project when the real, you know, we were not in a freedom school, we were not in a community center, and we were not organizing people to vote and become a part of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And that's the story of Mississippi Summer. Those things were the story in Mississippi Summer. So we were a little story to the side, I think. At the end of the summer, when everybody was leaving the state and going to work and going up to the Democratic Convention, there was a call went out to have people go to their projects to replace them, because so many people from COFO were going to the Democratic Convention along with the MFDP. So some of the projects wanted people to come in during that one-week period to sort of continue running the Freedom Schools and the Community Center. And mercifully and thankfully, I got to go to Hattiesburg, Mississippi at the end of the summer, for which I've always been eternally grateful. And I went and stayed in the home of Mrs. Victoria Gray, who was, of course, off being a committee woman for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. But I stayed in her house, worked in the Palmer's Crossing Community Center with students who had been in the Freedom School and who were still coming to the Community Center that summer, and got a bit of a feel for what it might have been like to be a part of a project that summer. But it was, I think, a good effort to try to do that, what we did. My Mississippi story ends 15 years later, when I went back to the first reunion of Freedom Summer, and it was held at Tougaloo. And I remember there were some meetings at the college, but then a few of us had gathered at the home of Ed and Jeanette King, who at that time were still together and who lived on the Tougaloo campus. And the thing that I remember most vividly about that reunion was the anger, and I think anger is the right word, but the anger and the disappointment expressed to people who were coming back into the state from the people who had lived there and stayed there. It was Willie Peacock, it was Hollis Watkins, and I believe that MacArthur Cotton was also there. But the people who lived in Mississippi, who had been important leaders in the southwest part of Mississippi, and Macomb, and other projects, and who had stayed. It gets to this issue of, you quoted Sally Belfridge about saying people had the privilege of leaving at the end of the summer, when we had, and there was, you could see, you know, 15 years later, the project was like, it didn't have the cachet that it later had, the Mississippi Summer Project. It was 15 years later, lots of other things were going on. A lot of people, there wasn't much talk about Mississippi then, and yet people were still there hanging on, trying to raise money, trying to keep community projects alive. And I remember thinking, yes, this is, you know, they're still here. And I was still in the South, you know, I had opted to stay in the South and continue working, but I wasn't in Mississippi full time, at least. So it was, that was a a hard moment, I think, to sort of recognize that there had been this incredible energy, attention focused on the state, and yet for some people who had stayed there and continuing to do political work had felt somewhat abandoned. And just remember. Thank you.
I'm not going to say much because it's really all been said. And last night we were having dinner, some of us that were here yesterday. And the most important thing that happened for me was the young women who were acting as our hosts raised some very important questions for us. And one of the questions they raised was, what is it that you want people to know about SNCC? And I thought that was really, really profound, because when Professor Payne talked about putting this together last year, it was only as she talked about it more that I could see how extremely important these lessons from the South could be used for social workers, for teachers going into another community. Because I think one of the things that you could hear in each of these talks, even though they're from three very different perspectives, that everyone was an outsider going into an insider community and experiencing tremendous tensions about doing that. There isn't any reason to assume that someone, because they were black, going into a rural area in Mississippi, were a part of that community. And listening to Zahora's story and understanding the kinds of tensions that particularly, young blacks were, for most of these people who were in college, fighting with their parents about, is this where I'm supposed to be? And having to make some very, very hard decisions. What do you, I could just feel the pain that you were experiencing, feeling that you were disappointing your grandmother. And, and Bob talking about, there you are at a family funeral with your cousin who's ready to kill you because you're involved in this movement. Sue talking very poignantly about continuing to organize organized white people when you're in the midst of a black movement. And so one of the things I want people to understand about SNCC is the transformative nature of this experience. And no one that was a part of this did not have their lives transformed. And I just want to point out two people. Pat Lucas is here running this camera today, but she went south to be part of the Mississippi Summer Project. It transformed her life in such a way that, she's still trying to record this. And I just have to say that, I'm sorry, I have to say it, Mildred Foreman Page, come on. Talk about transformation.
I've got the other.
Talk about transformations. Very much as Zahara talked about, going to Spelman, having a life planned out for you. Mildred, before she married Jim Foreman, certainly had a life planned out here in Chicago. Had what was at the time considered a good job, right? And Jim had a good job, and it looked like things were going to be everything he wanted them to be. The house, the car, a comfortable life. And then, as I understand it, you come in from work one evening and there is Diane Nash sitting there talking about what they really need Jim to do is to go south to organize these organizers. A transformed life, completely taken off the path that you were going. And so I guess what I'd like to see out of the session is to hear from people in the audience how you respond to these stories, because I think the stories, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm enthralled listening to them, and I don't know if it's just because, you know, it's such an integral part of my life, but for me it makes it all so real. This is just a little bit of a plug in my own. This book, which I'm sure most of you have read, makes it all seem so real. And one of the things that I'm often talking about is because Clay Carson's book on SNCC, which is one of the most boring things I've ever read, is often quoted. But one of the things, it's certainly very well researched, but one of the things that's missing is he completely misses the transformative nature of the organization and the significance of what we were really, really doing, and that is organizing at the base and building on the strength of those people that were there before us. So, just a little
thank you.
I get to follow all that. This insider-outsider thing, I'm also an outsider. I'm coming after this and responding to this. So I just want to follow up on that and ask a couple of questions, and then I'm done. I think Charles has got this discussion with John Dittmer one time, where he was raising the question of the outsiders coming in, and what you said, Shajessa, is what had to do with being white and what had to do with being outside Northerners. So I wouldn't mind if people could talk about that a little bit. And so I think that's an interesting question. The other big question I have is people mention these struggles around white and black, but I'd like to hear some stories of struggles that you felt were successful, got someplace, and what we could get out of them, and ones that didn't get someplace, and why they didn't get someplace. And I think I'll just leave it at that.
I actually like those questions, but I'm going to ask folks to respond to them. But given the hour, I am going to ask first. I know a lot of folks have a lot of questions. After the formal stuff ends at 2 o'clock, I think almost everybody is available to talk in small groups. But while we are still here together as a group, I think what I'm going to ask first is for the students. The first couple of questions come from the students, and then we'll sort of open it up to anybody. And there could be questions, reactions, tell your own story. But students first. I just put any pressure on anybody.
Hi, this is a generally directed question, so I want you to feel strong on it. I'm just curious, how did the movement find you, or how did you all come to it? Is it something personally that happened, you know, in your home or with friends, or is this something you saw on TV? How did you come to the movement?
Any two people?
Well, I can say quite quickly. I mean, you know, I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, where Jim Crow was the way of life. And so and you know what that means, you know, no facilities of any kind that you could use that were in any way decent, you know, coffee, food, you name it, you couldn't do it, you know. So clearly when the students began sitting in, and I was in the 10th grade in high school when that started happening. I mean, I was exhilarated, excited, happy, etc. So, and then I go to Spelman and I'm in Atlanta and the movement is all around me. I mean, SNCC is 3 blocks away, SCLC is a short bus ride away, Abernathy's Church. I joined that church without knowing it was Abernathy's Church, just because it was a Baptist church and a couple of blocks from the campus. I mean, you know, Stuart Lynn, Howard Zinn. I mean, so that's how I got involved. It was like, yeah, I've got to also fight for the freedom that I want.
The way I got involved with the group from SIT was going around to the colleges, and they were recruiting, actively recruiting. I was at Knox College in Edinburgh, Illinois, and Stanford.
I just put Angela in the back there, just left Knox College.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And they came around and recruited people. That's how I found out.
Anyone else, Paul? Well, I first found out about the movement when I was about 14 years old in East Bruton, Alabama, and I worked in a little country store, and after I had waited on an old black couple, my boss said, "You can't do that," and I said, "Why?" He said, "You said yes ma'am and no ma'am and yes sir and no sir to the people that were in here," and I said, "My parents have always taught me to be courteous to old people." And he said, "You can't do that because you'll get in trouble." And it was my first conscious memory that people of different colors are supposed to be treated different ways. And I said, "I don't understand it." And he said, "I hate to teach you this." And I guess my movement experience was that by happenstance, this person was a Unitarian Universalist in East Bruton, Alabama. And he said, "The reason I hate to teach you that is that it's wrong." He said, "But they know I'm a Unitarian Universalist. I'm in enough trouble already. You're going to get in trouble. You can't do it." And he said, "Okay, if it's just me and you, it's okay." And then he said, "No, you'll forget." So he was teaching me racial etiquette. When I was in high school, Authorine Lucy was the first black student to go to the University of Alabama. And I said, "I think it's a good idea." And my friend said, "Don't let anybody hear you say that." Second time I became aware that I had a little different view than my peers. I realized they were fearful. I said, "Who's going to hurt me if I said, I've told you that." They said, "Yes, but I know you're crazy." But they don't know you're crazy. So I began to see I'm somewhat different. But there was some spark that said to me, "I am not going to be like everybody else. I have a right to be free. I have a right to believe what I want to believe. And I don't care if I get in trouble. I will not live in fear." So that was the beginning of my movement. And when the sit-in started, and those were students my age sitting in, well-dressed, and we went to the prep school this morning. Very important. Well-dressed, those young people, they're in a movement of education. Well, that spoke to me as a young person who saw evil, and I said, "Here's the same age people studying the same things I'm doing. They're doing something about it. They're going against the power. Those are the people I need to be with."
Yeah, I think certainly for me, it was the Montgomery bus boycott, and seeing. I'd sit with my father in the evening and we'd watch the news. And my father was so excited about seeing these people day after day, day after day. And my father was a union man, and he said, "You see, this is what happens when people really band together. You see what they can do. That is so important. When people just band together, they see they can make change." And when the bus boycott was as successful as it was, and this momentum just kept growing and growing and growing, I knew that this was something I had to do something, I had to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. And I think particularly with the sit-in movement, with the students, seeing people my age, and they were sitting there so defiantly, and as you said, in those days, very, very well dressed. There wasn't anybody that could say, "Well, you know, there's something wrong with these people." But they so believed that they were right and that they were going to just come back day after day after day. You know, I began to get my little ticket sign and go out there alone on Saturday, picketing against Woolworths. And the other chains. And so, you know, it was, as Clint says, it was a river of no return. The more you got involved, you simply could not resist it. It was something far more powerful than you.
Okay. I have a question to follow, and as a red guy debater, you know that that someone who both of his parents were in the Communist Party. My mother is Jewish, my father is white, both of them were dissidents within that tradition, but also members of it. You could say I was born into the movement. But unlike many of my peers, whose parents also had that same background, and who reacted during the McCarthy era in a manner which caused them to hide their early radical affiliation, my parents couldn't hide, and neither could I. Because it didn't matter what they believed, it mattered what they looked like. Right? As soon as you walk out on the street, people know that you're breaking the law. Right? Mm-hmm. I grew up with that in my blood, and we grew up knowing we were quote-unquote enemies of the state, mm-hmm. also knowing that we were part of the communist menace, mm-hmm. even though we had our arguments with that tradition. But we were also very proud of that tradition. My first independent activity as a young activist was when I was a freshman at Hyde Park High School. And we organized two busloads of our contemporaries to go to Washington in 1958 for the Peace, Jobs, and Freedom March. From that period on, one of the things that happened to me in terms of transformative experiences as a 12-year-old at that point was that that was the last time, it was the first and last time I went to Washington on a big march. My view of that experience was that local organizing on the block and the community involvement, however long it might take, however immediately invisible you were to a wider audience, was the only thing that actually had the trenchancy to be transformative, not the one-day trip to a capital and you disappeared there. And so in the 60s then, although I was a member of SNCC and SDS, as I said yesterday, from 1962 to 1966, which were my college years, my view was that we were already in the South. I was born on the South side of Chicago, when my family had to leave here as a result of the McCarthy era. We went to South Central LA. It was South again, so I was already in the South. I didn't have to go any deeper South. I was already in the South. And in every community, as Fanny was saying, our community, we're aware of how segregated our situation was, even though it wasn't formalized institutionally the way it was in the Black Belt area of the South. And so my work tended to focus on where I was already living, even though I went on the Selma to Montgomery March. I came back, and I came back to Watts. And Jimmy Garrett and I and others as part of LA SNCC did a Freedom School and Writers Workshop in Watts. We were part of the movement in Watts at that particular time to declare Watts an independent municipality so that we could have sole governance. And that goes into the next session we're getting to, which is the beginning of the Black Power period. But to be responsive to the young man's question, my transformative moments primarily occurred in the context of being with others of my age, of different backgrounds, who were finding a way to be confident about our own capacity to both change each other as well as the communities in which they were.
No, Mrs. Paisley.
Oh, you want me to say how I can?
Please.
Okay, well, Fanny told you most of it. Jim and I were married in 1959, and he was a school teacher, and I was one of the few black school workers who was there for my coal company here in Chicago. I had a pretty good job. And we also, I mean, in my impression, I thought we were doing really good. We went on up. What I aspired to be. I wanted to be a housewife. I wanted to have a home. I wanted to have a picket fence. I wanted everything, children, everything. And one day, I came home from work, and he had told me, Diane and I could not remember who the young man was, but Diane and this young man were sitting on my couch talking to Jim. And then they told me...
Diane Nash.
And they told me that they wanted Jim to come and move south with them and just for a couple of months and help organize things. So I said, well, we'll talk about it. I'll think about it. We'll talk about it. So after they left, Jim said, well, you know, I'm going to have to go. I've got to go help. You know, that's my passion. Because Jim had been active prior to me. Jim had been very active with Freedom Tent City, which was a place in Mississippi where people have been put off of their land.
Fayette County.
Where they're put off the land, and they had, we have organized in Chicago. We asked people to bring clothes and canned goods and money. So we had clothes, canned goods, and money. My mom and dad's basement was packed out with that. We got a truck and drove all this stuff down there so the people could continue doing what they were doing. What they were doing is they were fighting against they were sharecroppers, and they had taken most of their money, and they weren't making any money, and so they were fighting for more money. They wanted their own land. So naturally, they were put off of the land by the boss. And that was the first thing that he was involved in. The second thing he was involved in was in Monroe,
North Carolina.
They had a demonstration. How he got there, I don't to the day know. I got a call that he was locked up in jail. During the summer, he didn't work. No summer idea. So he would go different places, would come back. So that was his second thing. And then came the students. And I think one name that was not mentioned and should be mentioned is Ella Baker.
Yeah.
Ella Baker was like over the student. She was like, I don't know what her title was, but she was helping the students get together and part of helping them organize because, you know, these students know, and we know how young people are. You just rush into everything, you just do anything. You do here, you go here, you do that. And you don't think about the consequences. So Jim's job was supposed to help them get organized, which he's a good organizer in some cases, but in a way, I don't know how he got kicked to that position, because I had to help him get organized. And so that was how that's not how I got involved. I had, just like many had said before, well, my parents are from Arkansas, and when we would travel south to homecomings and things, we would have to use the side of the road for the bathroom. We would have to pack our lunch here in Chicago, put it in the car, and eat it on the way down because we couldn't go in the restaurant. So I knew, as a young child going on, that there were some things that just weren't right. I also remember going in, when we went to Arkansas one summer. I guess I must have been about 7 or 8. And my aunt had taken us up to town because everything was down in the country. And when we came back, I remember her telling my mother and my father, you can't take her home to work.
and my mom did say, why? I said, she doesn't understand. So she went in, she jumped up there, and she asked for her Coke, and she asked for her candy, and we were walking down the street, and at that time, in this part of Arkansas, if you were coming this way, and a white person was coming this way, you had to step off the sidewalk and let them go by. Well, I didn't know that, and my aunt said she just had to keep snatching me, But, you know, so all of that had started growing in me, but I didn't really get to it and really realize that somebody's got to put a chance, that somebody's got to come. Well, when I met you, and we started talking and going around in different places, watching television, and I said, well, I guess he's got to go. So that's how he went to Atlanta for 2 months, and this was in August. In December, he came, because we said, we got to come home, we got to do something, because we were only married a year. So he came, and he said, would you please come and move with me to Atlanta? Just for 1 year. Him and I divorced. I have been there. When we divorced, I have been there 5 years. I left Atlanta 6 years later. Okay, thanks for coming. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
I just wanted to say one thing. Hearing everybody's stories and being excited about storytelling always. About 5 years ago, Sylvia Fisher and I. Well, that wasn't much of a stand. All right. But anyway, we began a project, the Chicago SNCC History Project, to try and record and preserve the stories of people in Chicago. Not necessarily people in leadership, but ordinary people. The people who really made up the bulk of the movement. Trying to record those stories. And about 2 years ago, we began doing this in the public high schools, trying to get kids to interview people who had been involved in the movement. And two things that we found out was that neither students nor teachers had any idea of anything about the movement except, you know, they came, they picked cotton, and they marched on Washington. And so that was a serious problem. But the other serious problem for us was that as we tried to get students to talk about the movement and the significance of the movement for contemporary issues, the most devastating thing for us was to hear and understand how powerless these young people felt, that they could not make change. They could not, whatever their lives were, that's just the way they were, but they did not feel that they could in any way make change. And I keep going back to last night's discussion and thinking, if anything, what I would want people to know about SNCC is that it is a moment when young people believe that they can make change. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what I'd like to see people take away.
Hi, thank you for that. We are running out of time, but since we started this, I want to end it thoroughly. So, Tim, and then you have to be brief, because I don't have a lot of time. But I'd like you, Sylvia, because there's a different path into activism. I'd like you to say something about how you became your whole lifestyle father. But Tim, you first.
Yeah, quickly.
I'm sorry. Tim U. L. Black.
Thank you. I used to be all of you all day. And I go back and little story that is true, but it's human to me. That's when I was 8 months old. I was born in Birmingham, Alabama. And legend has it, when I was 8 months old, I looked around in Birmingham and said, shit, I need to be that I get from people who came from the South to Africa at that time. Now, what many of the young people here need to understand is SNCC is a continuation of things that been started much earlier on this campus. An organization was started called CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, mixed primarily as an adventure school, wasn't it? As an adventure school, and I was a child of
Farmer.
And on and on it goes in the labor movement, where most of my life was spent. We were organized. Those of us who came out of World War II, the first time I'd been south that I wasn't protected was during World War II, and I couldn't believe I made all the mistakes. Because I didn't know anything about it. I wasn't trying to change anything. Getting on the bus in Richmond, sitting down, I got a soldier suit on, going overseas, knowing I'm going overseas, get on the bus, sit down, white guy and lady, I guess it was a lady, get on the bus, immediately I know what he's going to do, what he's going to do. Immediately, without even planning or thinking of it, I knew what I was going to do. I said to myself, in my emotional self, time to die.
Time to die.
That was my feeling.
Yeah.
And I hadn't thought about it, I hadn't planned it. That was my feeling. And so, when he went to the bus driver to tell me, I was sitting in the wrong place. I said, why don't you tell me when I got on? He said, why didn't it make any difference? And I went on with that, and I'm glad I was close to the train station. So I knew better when I got on this. But what is important for all of us to know, and all of you young people particularly, is the struggle that some of us, the snake youngsters, were the ones that opened the door to self. Selma, Alabama. The bridge was named Pettus.
Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Yeah, Bridge. They were the ones that took the beating. Mm-hmm. They were the ones that opened the door. Dr. King did come, he came later, and I'm not sure if he lived with Dr. King. But ordinary people open the doors for Dr. King.
That's right.
First bus tour time, it was the younger people, led by E.D. Nixon, who got to be a brotherhood of the Supreme Court. What's the name of him, please?
And Joanne Robinson.
But nonetheless, your memories are there. You can't always. What is important for me, the reason I came is that people like Sylvia Fisher. In the movement. She and her husband. And her children. In the movement. So you have a responsibility to continue the movement and whatever. Because I believe, I didn't like him necessarily, but Dwight Eisenhower said when we were losing the war in World War II in North Africa, and he was appointed general, and he said, impossible to do that immediately. And miraculous. Sometimes they live on. On November the 4th of last year, we achieved the impossible.
You're right.
Let's move and get the miraculous. All right. We deserve it. Your ancestors wanted it. Those who will come after you deserve it. Thank you.
Probably the last one that I know is just as tightly connected as just for you to say something about how you became involved
in the movement.
Yes.
Which movement?
I'm only going to be here.
Well, Tim and I go back same age.
I came out of the
I had
your story.
So you see, we go back and forth. But the story is too long because I grew up out of the Depression, and so I fought my way all the way through all my life. So it wasn't a very difficult story to the civil rights movement. But I was a teacher. I was also a social worker. Graduated from this school. And there was something about teaching that I just really loved, that I could also see, because most of my students were African Americans. What was happening to a whole new generation of young people as a result of the fact that they weren't given a chance in the most basic institution, that of education. So it was at one of the schools that I was teaching at that I had the very good fortune of having Jim, you may not know this story, as a substitute teacher at my class in my school, and he too taught my daughter Kathy. So we became acquainted because as we walked through the yard one day, kids were fighting, and it was just the beginning of a transition in this neighborhood when blacks were moving into the area and there was a lot of chaos going on. And the kids were fighting black and white and so forth. And there were a whole group of teachers walking through, but it was Jim and I together who went into the yard and separated the kids. And from that time on, we established a relationship. And so through the years, there was Ted City and Fayette County. And then when he went down south and there was a need for a support group, he turned to me. Mm-hmm. And so as a result of that, we established the Chicago Area Friends of SNCC. But I have to tell you something more about that. What we did initially was to raise money to send staff. But the group was made up not only of white, fairly well-to-do people, but African Americans as well, including Benny and it didn't take very long before the people in the committee began to address what the problems were here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, because how can you just only be going south when the problems also were apparent here? And of course, the biggest issue, guess what? Wasn't housing or the economics, was the schools. Mm-hmm. You had a situation, if you talk about segregation, that's where it really existed, because the lines were very clearly drawn. We were neighboring schools, we were in a district. You could have a white district with empty classrooms, and sitting right next to it, a black district with overcrowding, to the point where kids had to come to school on shifts.
Shifts.
You know, there was the AM shift, there was the PM shift. And then what they began to do was to bring in what we then dubbed at that time Willis Wagon. And this was named after the superintendent of schools at that particular time. And these were trailers that were put into the courtyards and so forth, and then the kids could have, would impair actually their freedom in terms of recreation and so forth. So this is where we began to protest again. And when committees were formed and were sent to have discussions with the Board of Education to have these removed, to redistrict the schools so that you can have some form of integration, but mostly a place for kids to sit down and learn. And of course, the other thing that was happening was your least experienced teachers, the poor books, no equipment, went into the school. This is Chicago. I don't think it was unusual in terms of any of the big cities, but this is what was happening. When we met with frustration in terms of attempting to bring about some change, we finally came to the conclusion the only thing we could do was to boycott the school. Now, this was a tremendous undertaking, and there were many other, the NAACP, the Urban League, the churches, the synagogues, they were all involved in this under a big community organization that existed at that time. And it was, we did it, we pulled it off. We had 250,000 students stay out of school for one day. And this was with the consent of parents, because we didn't have this happening without the cooperation of the And well, you would think that as a result of this that we would have won the day, but it took another boycott. Was it a year later, Fanny? Yeah. And then finally the board began to move, and they removed Willis, which was our objective, and things began to change little by little. So that was my introduction, or my involvement in the movement.
Became an interesting way to learn a lot of the Philly territory. If you look on the website for the biographies, which are actually longer than the ones we've set it up, you'll see that a number of people, even more clearly there than here, frame their activism in terms of the families that they come from. I'll say what, I built something as you go, and I have no idea what's in this room next. But until somebody comes and fills us out, is there any one more question here? Those of you who have to slide out. I want to see if any of the students have any questions before they come in.
I just inserted what Joe just did. Development is with them. Manny is also sitting. Larry Manning was a student at the University of Chicago.
In SSA?
SSA.
And that's the same as Larry Landry was.
Well, he was still here on UP, he's the one who tells who Larry Landry.
The co-chair of Chicago Mary Francis Smith.
He shared the responsibility. We were co-chair.
Co-chair of the
Chicago Mary
Francis Smith.
Okay, all right. All right. Well, we do have to break now. I think what we're going to do is the speakers will go downstairs, we'll both go off the table.